Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by one of our contributors, Ashanti Omka.
Hello.
Hello, and contributing editor, James Mottram.
Hello.
Hello. And this week we are weighing up DC's League of Super Pets, documentary Fire of Love, comedy drama Joyride, and ILM documentary Light and Magic. But before we get onto those, what have you been watching this week, Ashanti?
Okay, I've got three for you. One of them is already out. It's called Don't Make Me Go. It's on Prime Video. It's a father and daughter tale. It premiered at Tribeca Film Festival. And John Cho is just bringing us the goods at the moment. He's getting better and better. I just remember him as this guy in Harold and Kumar, but here he is showing his acting chops. This film is really beautiful. It has Maya Isaac, a young girl that I think everybody should be looking out for. Now, I can't talk much about this, but Jane and I were at the premiere screening, gala screening of Prey last night. And, you know, it's 35 years after Predator. And all I will say is that Prey is a modern cult classic coming to Disney Plus. And also to say that I've been working on the London Action Festival celebrating Predator this Sunday at Picture House Central with director John McTiernan in the house, legend. And also Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. I can't talk much about this. All I can say is it's a fairy tale. It's totally kind of taken my heart. I'd given an award to Leslie Manville back in the day at Critics Circle Awards for Phantom Thread. And here she is, you know, with this kind of new version of an old TV movie, Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, that had Angela Lansbury, who is a legend. And this retake on it, what can I say? I loved it. I'm sure you will too.
Well, we saw it this morning, didn't we, James?
Yes, we did. And we can't really talk about it too much, as you say. But
we're not allowed to say, but we did see it this morning. We sat in the dark for our morning screening. What else have you been watching, James?
I caught up with, it's been on Apple TV for a few weeks now, but Blackbird, the show with Taron Egerton and Paul Walter Hauser and Greg Kinnear. If anyone hasn't seen it, it's absolutely incredible. It's a prison drama based on a true story. Dennis Lehane is behind it, and an incredible performance by Paul Walter Hauser as a very strange antisocial character who's in prison. That Taron has been put in prison to try and extract some sort of confession from him. That's all I'll say. But it's an incredible piece of work. I watched the final episode this week. And another bit of telly, I'm waiting now for the, well, I haven't watched this week's yet, but Better Call Saul, the countdown is on. It's only three episodes to go until the very end of that incredible show, possibly becoming one of the greatest TV shows ever. Controversial statement, maybe.
More so Breaking Bad?
I love Breaking Bad. I think what they've done as a prequel is incredible, though. It's just as good in its own way, possibly better. Very different, but brilliant. So, yeah, I cannot wait till August the 9th is the last episode. I will be turning off the phones that day and not looking at any spoilers on the internet either.
Yes, yes. Don't look at Twitter. They don't like to preserve a spoiler on social,
do they? No, they don't.
I remember talking to Paul Walter Hauser when he was doing Cruella, about Blackbird, and he was finding the process of finding that character very interesting at that time. It's certainly, I would say, a better performance than the strange Cockney thing he does in Cruella. So, yeah, it is a good one. I watched Gladiator this weekend, which I haven't watched for ages, and I wanted to see if it still stood up. Obviously, having enjoyed Russell Crowe in his Gladiator-esque outfit in Thor Love and Thunder, I thought I might revisit Maximus Decimus Meridius. And it still did. It still was an absolute cracker.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained? Is this not why you are here?
Still love it as much, even though it is 3 hours. And I can remember seeing that the first time and needing the loo within about half an hour and thinking, oh man, I've totally timed this wrong. But anyway, so that's not just my only thought about Gladiator, just to be clear. It's a very good film. Right, shall we talk about what we can watch this week on the big screen? It's time to find out if DC's family film is Kryptonite or Dynamite. It's this.
I have an owner, and he's Superman.
Let me just iron that out. They should call me Iron Man. No. My dog's the best, but he's not the greatest with other animals.
What is new with you, fellow normal dog?
I bit the FedEx guy the other day.
Who was he working for? General Zod? The Legion of Doom?
FedEx.
Of course. The Federation of X's. Not to be trusted.
What is taking my owner so long?
This is DC's League of Super Pets. I mean, I think it's obvious what this is about, James, but fill us in.
Well, it comes up with the idea that when baby Superman left planet Krypton all those many moons ago, he was accompanied by a little pup, a Labrador retriever. And we see that in the very beginning of the film. And then it cuts to sort of grown-up Superman with his faithful hound, voiced by Dwayne Johnson. John Krasinski is voicing Superman. And the hound, having come from Krypton, can actually fly, much like his master. There's a lot of characters in this film because you have all of the Justice League turn up. There's Batman, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, The Flash, Aquaman, Cyborg. Don't forget Cyborg. So they're all there. And then there's an animal shelter, which Superman has popped over to try and get a pal for Crypto. That's the name of his dog. There in cages is Ace, another dog voiced by Kevin Hart. There's a squirrel voiced by Diego Luna. What else do we have in there? There's a crazy
hairless guinea pig.
The hairless guinea pig. That's that who basically is voiced by Kate McKinnon and has developed a crazy plan to take over the world. And it goes on from there. So the hairless Lulu is the enemy and comes up with this sort of crazy scheme. And the dog, Crypto, ends up teaming up with Ace and the other animals to try and stop Lulu. Meanwhile, the Justice League and Superman are all sort of imprisoned due to events I won't go into because it's going to go on for too long. Yeah, it goes on from there. It's a sort of crazy, colourful sort of adventure directed by Jared Stern, who wrote or co-wrote the Lego Batman movie. But it has lots and lots of sort of fun little jokes, fun little sight gags. The dog plays with a squeezy Bruce at one point, which is a sort of squeezy Batman toy. There's references to Iron Man, Garfield. If you remember Garfield, that's one for our generation, I would say. There's references to Paw Patrol, which is definitely not our generation. It's just a kind of fun, lighthearted cartoon that obviously, you know, uses all the DC lore, and a bit of Marvel creeps in as well.
Did you enjoy it?
I did quite enjoy it. I did. I thought there were bits that did make me laugh out loud. I thought there were far too many characters in the end. You know, as I mentioned, you got this kind of animal posse who at one point all gained superpowers. You have the Justice League posse who don't have a great deal to do, but you do get some fun elements. I thought Keanu Reeves voices Batman. I thought he was very funny as Batman, perhaps not quite as good as Will Arnett in the Lego Batman movie, but definitely up there.
But hey, it's Keanu.
Yeah, it's Keanu. So that was great. So there were elements I really liked. I thought it got a little plot heavy in the second half, lots of running around, lots of collisions and catastrophes. And I kind of got a bit bored then. And it wasn't quite as emotional as you get, say, from a Pixar movie. It didn't have that level of
It did
of
have
joy
a little bit of a Pixar sort of section in it, though, didn't it? I mean,
which bit was that?
But there's a backstory for Ace that is really quite affecting. Did that not, you know, give your heartstrings a little tug?
No, not really. But it was, you know, there were lots of things that I enjoyed about it. It wasn't quite on that sort of satirical Lego movie kind of level or the kind of heart-tugging Pixar level either. But it had elements of both that, you know, it got me through it.
That's faint praise. Ashanti, did you like it any more?
I liked it more. I think this film is definitely aimed at children. It's how to get small children into superheroes. And I echo a lot of what James says. This is no kind of Lego Batman. This is a very different film. But, you know, Keanu Reeves has always, it's been his dream to play Batman. And it was a dream for me to hear him playing Batman, certainly. And I found it lots of fun. I love that Jamila Jamil is playing both DC and Marvel characters now. She was Wonder Woman in this. I liked a lot about it. I definitely want squeaky toys of, or squeezy toys rather, of all of them. I would like to have a little collection, you know. And I thought it was good fun. I did feel that this is the sort of film I would like to take the nephews and nieces to go and see as a family outing. Certainly not something I would sit at home or go to watch with my other half. At the same time, I just thought, you know, Lex Luthor was stylized so well. His outfits were just incredible. I did like how they turned the, you know, the superhero suits into this kind of very flat animation. I found that quite different. It felt like animation from maybe 10 years ago. It didn't feel like this new state-of-the-art animation that we get to see quite a lot. I really liked, you know, how the evil characters, how they almost evolved and how the good characters kind of came together. I liked all of that. And I have to say, I was very happy that they were very careful when casting The Flash.
Yes. Less said about that, the better. I mean, yeah, no. I mean, this is written by somebody who had involvement with the Lego movies, but it's nowhere near as sharp as that, is it, on the page? I think the thing that probably elevates this is the voice cast. And this is a $7 production, which is, you know, the shingle that Dwayne Johnson works under. So, of course, his bestie, Kevin Hart, is in there as Ace. And, you know, Kevin Hart and Dwayne Johnson, I will watch them do anything together, and the bants they have. And they have really good bants here. And Kate McKinnon as this psychotic hamster who...
Gerbil.
No,
she's not keen on hamsters, is Lulu.
She's a guinea pig.
She's a guinea pig.
Sorry, guinea pig.
There you go.
There you go. Okay. I never had a guinea pig or a hamster or a gerbil as a child, so I can't tell the difference between
So she is a guinea pig because she's a lab guinea pig. But like she, with Kate McKinnon's brilliance, manages to make lines that are so really funny. And that's not to do with the script, really, or the animation. It's purely her voice talent. And so I feel like the cast has elevated this up to be a better film than it actually really is. I don't know how you guys feel about that.
Completely agree about that. I think they hit the nail on the head with the casting for this. I mean, I've just been watching I Love That For You, and Vanessa Bayer as the pot-bellied pig, for example, I thought that she was absolutely fabulous. She kind of embodied a lot of things I had always thought of myself and my self-esteem. And this was all about how she comes into her own, how she wields her powers after learning to understand herself. So there were lots of bits in this that I thought were really cleverly made. Olivia Wilde as Lois Lane, again, she didn't have much of a part, but what part she had was nice. Mark Maron as Lex Luthor, again, I actually really
liked
Natasha
Lyonne as a like far out sweary tortoise.
Yes.
I mean, there's quite a lot of swearing. I mean, it's beeped out. But that tortoise is a potty mouth for a kids' film, right?
It is true.
That was quite funny. The bit where her swearing does get beeped out. I thought that was quite a clever idea. I think we've got Diego Luna as well as the squirrel who gets electro powers at one point. No, it is an absolutely fantastic cast. You're right. That is the sort of selling point of the film. I wasn't actually that keen on Kate McKinnon's performance. I have to say, I thought it was way too over the top. But
it's a hairless guinea pig.
I know it's a hairless guinea pig.
That has designs on the world.
I know. I know.
How over the top do you want to go?
I know. I'm aware of this, but I don't know. I just thought it was straining a little bit too much for comedy, her performance. But I like Dwayne Johnson in it. I thought he played the kind of eager to please dog very, very well. I think the slight shame is that Kevin Hart was in The Secret Life of Pets, which I think is a better pet-related cartoon, and he played Snowball, the psychotic rabbit, in that. Yeah. So it's kind of, it came a little bit too close to that. I thought that he's, if not repeating himself, because it's a very different character, but, you know, perhaps we could see Kevin do perhaps not a pet-related cartoon in the future.
Also, sorry, one more thing. I have to say, the Great British Bake Off makes an appearance.
It does.
That's a great sequence where he's eating ice cream and crying and watching Bake Off. That was very funny. I didn't realise how massive Bake Off clearly is in America.
Truly. I didn't either till I saw it. I've seen it in so much pop culture lately. And this kind of solidifies the fact that we're doing something really well here in the UK.
Yeah, Paul Hollywood and his soggy bottoms gets a shout out. So, the calming and sort of therapeutic nature of Bake Off is celebrated in this. So would we recommend that people go to see this? Do you go if you have kids and not if you don't? Because it's like you'd only go and see this if you were trying to entertain someone over the summer holidays.
I think that's exactly right. Take your kids, take your nieces and nephews, as Ashanti said. But yeah, if it's just you and your other half, maybe wait till it comes on streaming.
So that is DC's League of Super Pets, which is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, it's time to get hot and steamy with this.
This is Katya, and this is Maurice. Tomorrow will be their last day. They will leave behind hundreds of hours of footage, thousands of photos, and a million questions. Alone, they could only dream of volcanoes. Together, they can reach them. They meet on a blind date at a cafe. From here on out, life will only be volcanoes, volcanoes, volcanoes.
This is Fire of Love. It's not a saucy film. It's not a steamy thriller. What is it about, Ashanti?
I kind of went into it blind. I'd seen these amazing posters all over London thinking, this looks absolutely fabulous. Look at all this kind of molten lava everywhere. And obviously I'm the sort of person who likes that kind of thing. And I went to this, it's a documentary film. It's written, directed and produced by Sara Dosa, I think is how we'd pronounce her name. And, you know, she's kind of won a Peabody Award. She's had Emmys and Independent Spirit Award nominations. So she's done some really good work. And in this case, it's about these two volcanologists. Now, I'd never in my life thought about that, even saying that word.
As a thing, as a job.
As a thing, saying that word, it's a new word to me, you know. And Katia and Maurice, who I felt were quite good characters, Croft is their surname. And these are two people who just literally love to walk into fire. The sad thing about this film is that if people know their history, they know that these are two people who ultimately died in this volcanic, you know, explosion. And they were filmmakers in a way, because when you see this film and the way they've crafted it, and I love how Sarah has kind of edited this film to make it, and she's worked with two other editors, Erin and Jocelyn, to edit this film through, to make it all very cohesive. And initially, I kind of thought, is this a reenactment of these two people? Or is this actually them? Is this actual footage that they're using? And is this real archival footage? Because they made it look like, you know, it's something that's been reenacted and created. And
yeah, it sort of plays dramatically, even though it's actually a documentary,
yes,
right?
Exactly, 100%. And for me, you know, there's a line in the film also that when it's narrated, saying that it almost feels like, you know, and Miranda July says this, it feels like these two people, Katia and Maurice, were they thinking of the dramatics? You know, there were scenes where they would show Katia being, you know, she's pondering, for example, and they would actually then give you a close-up. And it just felt like, whoa, were these people thinking of all of this? Did they know there was going to be an ultimate demise? And, you know, Katia has this undying love for her husband. She says that wherever he goes, she will follow. And there was a lot about this film that just opened my eyes to volcanic explosions and what they've done, the devastation they've done to the places and villages and thousands, you know, like 30,000 people at any one given time can die when one of these things erupts. And, you know, the way volcanoes work, having been at primary school a very long time ago, I didn't know a lot of these details. So it was kind of a refresher course for me. And I have to say, I was very moved by it. And just the fact that these two people had this passion for their job, such a passion that they would take the risk of dying for it.
Mm. Yes, you could see it as that, as passion. You could also see it as foolhardy and vainglorious, which is how I saw it. I did not like this film. I did not like the voiceover by Miranda July. How did you feel, James?
Yeah, well, first of all, I didn't know that the voiceover was Miranda July until long after the film had finished. And I did think to myself, who is this doing the voiceover? Maybe I assumed it was the filmmaker, not recognizing Miranda's voice. But as soon as I discovered it was Miranda July's voice, I went, oh, well, that makes sense. Because it was this kind of slightly, how could you describe it? Ethereal, slightly whiny voiceover, soporific might be another word. Just, you know, maybe want to drift off to sleep. And I was kind of thinking, oh, well, she probably couldn't afford to get anyone big. So she just had to do it herself. It's a shame her voice sounds a bit like this. But no, it turns out that it's Miranda July. Yeah, the voiceover was probably my least favorite aspect of it. On the plus side, I thought the footage of the volcanoes was absolutely staggering, purely as a nature documentary, a kind of National Geographic type piece. It's worth seeing for that because we've all seen sort of volcanoes on TV or whatever, but the kind of close-up footage these guys got is just incredible. As a love story, I found it less interesting, though. As Ashanti said, that this idea of how passionate they were was really interesting. There's quite a lot of focus on Maurice rather than his wife, though. And Maurice is kind of irritating. I mean, at one point, he wants to basically canoe down a lava flow, which kind of just shows you where his head is at. That also shows you kind of how much of a, and I use the word loosely, a visionary he was. He's obviously completely mad as well, or was. You know, I mean, they were a fascinating pair, whether you bought into their sort of explosive, fiery love story. I don't think I did. But I did find the close-up footage of the volcanoes was amazing. But of course, you do have to get over Miranda July's voiceover as well.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, James. I mean, you cannot take away from this couple their incredible footage. And for that, you know, congratulations. But, you know, they put themselves in danger. They put other people in danger, you know, trying to get them away. You know, like, I don't necessarily believe that they were searching for the clues to volcanoes simply for the good of man. It felt very much like they sort of had a weird death wish almost. And I found Maurice particularly annoying and his little red hat. I sort of compare it to the Jacques Cousteau documentary that we saw earlier this year, that was also a lot of real footage of Cousteau and his sort of driving force to explore the ocean. And they feel like completely different beasts. And I don't really know. I mean, I could be just being horrible about the crafts because of the way they've been portrayed in this film. And it could be that they were wonderful people, but I found them incredibly irritating. Miranda July, I was just like, leave it, love. Just stop with your poetry of lava or whatever it is that you're talking about. I don't want that in my documentary. I just don't. I found it incredibly pretentious and incredibly tiresome. So, yeah, I know other people have loved it, and I'm in the minority. I know that too.
Just to say, Jane, they did affect change because that one of the things that I think was a smaller part of the documentary and should have been a bigger part, and I agree, where you couldn't obviously see that, but they did affect change in the sense that governments who were not taking much notice of these people who were living near the volcanoes started to take notice after these two people campaigned, and annoying as the guy might have been a little bit, you know, because he did have that kind of pompous annoyingness about him. I felt that he put a super persona so that he could go out there and promote the hell out of this so that people and governments would take some notice, because all these poor people who were living near these volcanoes, and they had no other choice. They felt like they were living in a safe place and they weren't given any warnings. The governments are now saying, okay, warning signs are coming. They have affected some change, which I liked about it.
No, I'm not saying that they weren't trying to do that, but it feels like that fed into another drive, which was the getting as close as humanly possible, so close that you can canoe down a lava flow. I mean, that says it all to me.
Yep, they had a death wish for sure.
Yeah, I mean, or at least they're daredevils or something. They're like those kind of people that jump out of planes or bungee jump, or it's that. I mean, there's one shot of his, I think it's his leg that's been burnt by a load of, well, obviously not lava that's going to burn through your entire leg, but it's scalded his skin. And you just think, my God. And he seemed to find it quite an amusing, a sort of a badge of honour, I suppose.
Yeah, badge of honour.
He was a true showman. I mean, his ability to go on TV shows and basically to raise money for their lifestyle and sort of lecture. And, you know, what they did was admirable in the sense of they turned their passion into a career. But yeah, they were kind, particularly he was kind of crazy. I think you could make another film a very different film about them, which would be quite interesting, you know, perhaps more focusing on the natural environment that they worked in, less about this, you know, intense love story. That may be just as interesting. I don't know. But
yeah, I felt like I wanted to know about their work without having this sort of layer of love and passion and sort of this. It felt crowbarred. It really felt like, hey, what if we do a volcano thing, but it's a, you know, about the passion of love that erupts from these two. And it's like, yeah, great. And also I must say, hold my hand up, I saw this in a festival, so this could be that I was just furious with having eaten nothing but like a weird sandwich all day and queuing from, you know, 7:30 in the morning, and had seen so many films by that stage that my brain was addled, because I know the reviews for this are great.
Well, I think seeing it on the big screen, as Ashanti obviously did.
I did too.
That's obviously the place to see it, mainly for the footage, yes. For the volcano footage.
Yeah, and it, you know, volcano porn, it absolutely is. And if you love a volcano, this is going to be absolutely amazing for you. I think we're saying go see it. Just don't listen to me.
Yes.
Fire of Love is out in cinemas on Friday. Do see it on the big screen. Don't wait for it on a small screen. Speaking of Miranda July and her particular brand of narration, I'm going to do alternative line reading in the style of her. And as always, this is a line reading for somebody we've already discussed, but what film is it? I'm trying to save the world, which, for the record, may be my fourth time because I'm really good at it.
Gosh. Who can that be? Who have we talked about? Keanu Reeves? Not from The Matrix, is it?
It is an action-y one, obviously. Saving the world.
Yeah. Hobbs and Shaw.
Yes, it is. A Shanti.
It's got to be.
Yes, it is Dwayne Johnson as Hobbs telling Shaw how he's better than him on a plane. And it sounds like this.
I'm trying to save the world, which, for the record, will be my fourth time, because I'm really good at it.
Okay, here's on to another film that's out this week. It's time to buckle up. It's this.
If a plane to catch,
you're going to come with me and help look after the baby. In return, I won't press charges.
How is she doing?
She's fine.
Well, how do you know if you won't check?
Because she's giving me a little thumbs up.
We'll play question for question, but you have to tell the truth.
You can't be arsed to fight, would you?
What's the baby's name?
Robin. My name's Joy. I know, false advertising. Not the bringer of joy, apparently.
You're a mentalist.
I'm practical and solution-orientated.
You just have to trust me.
So this is Joyride. Ashanti, tell us about this one.
Okay, well, I'm going to put my hand up straight away and say that I am a huge Olivia Colman fan, so anything she's in, pretty much I'm going to be gushing about. And in this, as usual, she's bringing her A game. She's acting with Charlie Reid, a young teenager from Ireland who has been plucked out of almost oblivion. He's only 14 years old, and he's in this kind of feel-good movie, Joyride. And I would say it is one of those feel-good movies, and I really needed one when I watched it. And it's a kind of a coming-of-age comedy film, and Emma Reynolds has directed this film. And it's all about a young boy who's trying to get away from his father, who is an alcoholic, and he grabs some money and tries to dash off in a car. And in that car, he finds Olivia Colman and her baby. Now, she wants to give away her baby. She hasn't bonded at all with her baby. This boy, I mean, wow, he plays a boy called Mully, and Joyride comes from the name of the character of Olivia Colman, who is Joy. And this boy, Mully, is like, you know, on one hand, he's a typical teenager. On another hand, he's absolutely so, so, so endearing. At the start of the film, you'll see him carrying the baby, for example, and soothing the baby. And you just kind of fall in love with him and think, wow, this boy has so much talent. Olivia Colman and him have lots of chemistry. They literally go on this joyride, and some might say that, oh, it feels very contrived the way this narrative and screenplay runs. But on my part, I actually really loved it, and these scenes in Ireland were beautiful, and the chemistry between them, and just the fact that they're showing this teenage boy as this compassionate kid, you know, who helps this woman who's a, you know, a bit of a mess to make sense of her life. And I actually loved the way they did that. And I felt, again, you know, kudos goes to Emma Reynolds, because it's nice to have that female gaze. And I mention it quite a lot when I watch films, that, you know, when women give these sort of stories, they capture motherhood and friendship, things that are touching and warm. And also there were lots of funny moments that I really loved in this. So it's definitely a thumbs up for me.
Is it a thumbs up for you, James?
No, I found it quite irritating, actually. Ashanti used the word contrived, which it definitely is. I think the boy, Charlie Reid, is great. He gives a fantastic performance. I'm sure we'll see him again in something else. It wasn't really the performances that bothered me. It's not quite a two-hander, but it largely is. And I found both their characters quite irritating. Yeah, it just didn't really do it for me. Though it does feature Ultravox's Dancing with Tears in My Eyes, which is a fantastic track from the 80s. I'm making my bid for the closing track now, by the way, of the pod with that song.
Okay, let's see.
Yeah, let's see. But yeah, largely it just didn't really do it for me. I mean, I do like Olivia Colman in certain things. I mean, obviously she's fantastic in The Favourite, you know, The Lost Daughter recently and The Father. I do find that she's slightly overexposed as well. She's done a lot of stuff recently. I feel like this was something you didn't need to do this. It's just, I don't know, the script needed work. Yeah, it just didn't do it for me.
Interesting. I think I fall between the two of you. I loved the kid. I thought the kid was delightful. What a talent, what a find. I can't wait to see what he does next. And the sort of relationship between, you know, Mully and Joy, I found really interesting. And I also found it interesting to see, you know, motherhood presented as something that you don't want. But I think there's a better film that Olivia Colman's already done about that, which was The Lost Daughter. So this is not in any way as nuanced and as interesting as that film, but it's very accessible. It's very sort of brisk. It's, you know, gritty without being too gritty. It's one of those films that if you fancy watching something that isn't too much, it'll pass the time. And she's very good and her accent is very good, but you do have to question why they couldn't have found a really great Irish actor to play an Irish mother, why it has to always be Olivia Colman. But I do love her. I do love her. I think she's so good. And, you know, there's scenes in this that I found heartbreaking. And I love a sweary child. Everyone knows that I love a sweary child. And again, this kid swears like a trooper, which I found amusing. Sue me.
Maybe he should be in the film with the turtle tortoise from DC League of Super Pets.
Yeah.
Then you could get some mega swearing.
Tortoise teenager swearing. Let's do it.
We could pitch that to Warner Brothers tomorrow.
Yes. Yes. Sweary kids. Just, it's funny. I would say see it if it's raining and there's not much else to do. Or you're on a plane. I think it'd be a perfect plane movie. One of those ones.
Yeah,
that's not
it would
too
be
demanding.
A good plane movie. Good plane movie.
But otherwise, it's out in cinemas tomorrow. You can make your own mind up whether you're with James or Ashanti on that. Listen to that noise. We know what that sound means. It's time for our final item of the week. It's this.
Visual effects create the magic that makes people want to go to the movies. Movies are special effects.
We start with an empty frame. Anything is possible.
As audiences see through the illusion, the bar just raises.
How do we do this now? How do we make this look great?
I leave it to the geniuses at ILM.
James, light and magic. I think we can guess what this is about. Fill us in.
Light and magic. Well, preceded by the word industrial. It is, of course, a six-part documentary on Disney Plus about Industrial Light and Magic, the incredible team of visual effects artists that was set up by George Lucas when he was making the original Star Wars. And this is a show that really goes behind the scenes. The first two episodes are dedicated to the setting up of the company and how Lucas needed that company to make these groundbreaking visual effects for Star Wars that had never been done before. The array of talent on show here, the sort of talking heads, you've got Steven Spielberg, you've got J.J. Abrahams, you've got Lucas, James Cameron. I mean, you could go on and on. But just as importantly, you've got some people that you may only be dimly aware of by sort of reading their names on credits at the end of films. John Dykstra, for example, who was the visual effects supervisor on Star Wars. Now, he's not someone I knew a great deal about. He's very, very entertaining, very present in the first couple of episodes. I won't say what happens to him after those two episodes, because that's quite a good piece. That's something I didn't know, that his path after Star Wars. Then sort of episode 3 takes us into The Empire Strikes Back. Episode 4 takes us into kind of Raiders of the Lost Ark and E.T., amongst other things. This is about the time they needed to keep the company open while Lucas was still writing Return of the Jedi. So they started opening up to sort of friends of Lucas's to sort of do their visual effects. Poltergeist is another film that came around that time. Then I got up to sort of episode 5, where you get the kind of new breed coming in, guys like Steve Williams and Mark Duplay, who worked on Terminator 2 and Jurassic Park. And then there's a 6th episode. I haven't even tasted that yet, but I'm very excited because this was right up my street, this show. The behind-the-scenes footage, I've not trawled through all of the sort of Star Wars making of documentaries that there must be, and there must be hundreds of them. But a lot of this footage I'd never seen, and it obviously is coming straight from the ILM archives. Just is kind of a bunch of, you know, late 70s youngsters who got together. They, you know, they all had a love of special effects when they were young. They were just breaking ground, doing crazy things to try and make these special effects work. I mean, you see them in homemade hot tubs and slip and slides have just funny little stuff like that. You know, it's a cliche, but they were one big family, and it really, really comes across in this show.
Yeah, they describe themselves, don't they, as the Rebel Alliance at one point, and that they're sort of like, you know, that this is like the real life behind the scenes Han Solo and Luke and Leia and sort of trying to create this new world and out of the darkness, the light that they're bringing. I've only seen 2 episodes, James. I'm not as far on as you are, but I just think it's just so inspiring to see them create magic, literally, with the little models that they've got, and they're all sort of working crazy hours. And as you say, they're doing sort of barbecues in the downtime and firing off each other, and this creativity that they have. And they're sort of literally doing things that nobody has seen before and creating effects that no one thought possible. It's fascinating. And I love all the footage that they've got. Like, it's not just people talking about this time. You do have the footage of them messing around in their studios and all of the artwork on the walls and the mess of it and the plywood and the bits of papier-mâché and all of that stuff. And it feels really sort of tangible. I loved it. Did you like it, Ashanti?
Oh, gosh. You know what? I was completely hooked. I've only got to episode 3. And as James says, there are lots of deep things that these people are saying of how affected they were during this work and what's happened to them doing this work. And it feels very timely because at the moment, I'm sure you've heard about this, that there have been some VFX artists saying that they're working crazy hours.
Yeah, the Marvel pressure is extreme.
Is extreme. And I feel like they all should see this to understand where it all came from and why it not only is extreme, but the technology they have now makes everything so much easier than what these guys had, because these guys were living, breathing, sleeping it. And what they achieved at that time, you know, but back then trying to use blue screens, which have now become green screens, creating morphing, where technology has just kind of now grown to a point where it's so much easier to create a Miss Marvel, for example, and her embiggening than ever before. And this, I feel, is one of the most inspirational documentaries I've seen in a very long time. It's so real. We got to feel and live what these guys lived. I was sad not to see that many women, but it's a product of its time. And in that first episode, when they introduced the woman as, she was the PA, the secretary to the man, and that's what she was doing. And I thought, yeah, that's true. Back then, women weren't encouraged to go into this kind of career. And it's really interesting to see all of that and look at this in a historical way. And the amount of detail they've put into this documentary is just completely mind-boggling. And
I mean, it's totally for nerds, for film nerds. This is just everything you want, isn't it?
True.
Complete nirvana, basically. I also liked, I kind of expected it as a sort of Disney Plus production, let's say. I thought, oh, it's going to be very corporate. It's going to be very towing the line. And it will be interesting to see when we get up to Jurassic Park, where you have Dennis Muren, who was an effects supervisor on that, and the guys I mentioned earlier, Steve Williams and Mark DePay, who'd already kind of worked on the kind of molten guy in Terminator 2, you know, the T-1000. And they were sort of partly responsible for sort of doing these digital images of the T-Rex in Jurassic Park. But they were quite rebellious at the time. And we'll find out when we get to those later episodes if it will tell that story. But I get the feeling they will. If they've introduced them and they're interviewing them, I think they'll tell their side of the story and get the recognition they deserved. So it's not a sort of just, oh, you know, this is the most corporate sort of, you know, thing. That it does go into sort of conflicts. You know, I mentioned John Dykstra earlier. Yes. That whole segment was really interesting as to what happens to him. So, yeah, it's not afraid of broaching touchy, you know, touch the nerve kind of subjects.
Yeah, and I also think it's kind of interesting watching it as well when we've seen sort of things like We Crashed, you know, like people trying to make a company. We've seen how this can go terribly wrong and the downfall of a company that's a great idea. And then to see that this is what people are striving to do when they create companies. The ILM is created out of expertise and passion and then grows and grows and grows and grows and is now this huge powerhouse. And this is the story of success. But as you say, it's not an entirely smooth journey to that success. And it's really interesting how they get there.
Absolutely. And I have to say that I can't wait for the episode when they hit The Mandalorian, because I'm a huge fan. And even in the kind of starting credits, they kind of end with that where you see the Mandalorian carrying Baby Yoda and or Grogu, as I should call him.
The child.
And the child. I just cannot wait to see that. And also, I was really interested in this whole thing of rendering 3D, which, you know, back in the day, you couldn't even think of something like that happening. And the way they created Star Wars, for me, that completely was mind-boggling, because what we've seen on screen and we've grown up watching, the way they created it with real-life objects, you know, it's like, let's just get some foil together.
Yeah,
it's properly
like a Blue Peter type thing, isn't it? Just like mushing stuff together and sort of making it happen. Really creative.
Totally. And also there is an ILM in London and I'm hoping to pop by and see it at some point.
Okay, so if you fancy getting a bit of light and magic in your life, that is streaming on Disney Plus now. Well worth watching for education and for inspiration. It's a corker. Okay, so that is it this week. What is your film of the week, James?
Well, it'll be TV show of the week because I'll definitely go for Light and Magic.
Ashanti?
Tough one for me because I agree with James. I also feel like Light and Magic is the one to watch. It's worth dedicating half a day and just watching it back to back because it is riveting viewing.
I agree. Light and Magic is, you know, if you're into movies, it's essential viewing. The rest, I would say, are not. Okay, so we will be back next week. But before we go, there's time for a reader's question. What's the best boozing scene in a movie, James?
Well, you could choose any number from With Nell and I.
Yes.
So I'm going to choose the bit where they go in the pub and ask for, we'll have another pair of pints and some quadruple scotches and then go in the cake shop, basically.
Yes, and demand the finest wines known to humanity.
Exactly, abusing the patrons.
Ashanti?
Jane knows my love for Tom Cruise. And, you know, he was in Cocktail. And, you know, that scene with the last barman and...
It's such a shit film, though, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, honestly, when I saw it... And
don't mince words or anything like that.
I hate Cocktail.
As a child, I just loved it. I just thought it was all so cool, the way they were just tossing those kind of bottles and...
Tossing those women around as well, you know, just... Devil may care with a bottle or a woman. Doesn't matter. Throw it around.
I grew up in the patriarchy. So for me, I feel like I'm unlearning some of these things. And when Jane points them out to me, I'm like, oh, yeah. But at the time, I loved it. And I thought it was a great scene.
Mine's going to be the boozy scene on the orca in Jaws. I love that scene where they're all slightly tiddly. They slightly forget what they've come out on the sea for. And start to bond, but albeit in a sort of comparisons way, you know, look at my scar. And then it leads to this amazing monologue by Robert Shaw about the SS Indianapolis and the shark circling. I just think that scene is perfection in the way it's written, the way it's shot, and the way it's delivered by those actors. Booze.
Hang on, you missed out the bit where they sing "Show Me the Way to Go Home."
Show Me the Way to Go Home, which as a child, my brother and I used to sing all the time, and it's totally inappropriate for a child really to sing boozy shanties, isn't it? But yes, "Show Me the Way to Go Home." Yes, with the.
Exactly. Yep, that may now have taken the closing song rather than Ultravox's "Dancing with Tears in My Eyes."
We will see. We're about to see, James, because you're about to say goodbye, and we will see what we'll go out with. So say goodbye.
Bye.
Say goodbye, Ashanti.
Bye.
And it's bye from me. What's the song going to be?
Show me the way to go. You can always hear me.